Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of the OIG Roundtable. A little different today. It's really more of an OIG triangle than a roundtable. Wade and Jason are taking a much-needed day off, but I've still got my compadre, Matt Kachansky, here. Matt, for those of you that have not tuned in to the podcast, Matt is a retired executive from HHS OIG, who I worked with for 25 or so years, went on to be the director of the Northeast UPIC, and is now on our SIU team here. And we have a special guest today. We thought we would change things around a little bit for this week's OIG roundtable. We have a great guest that we're going to talk to about some compliance-related things in the billing and coding world. Have it a little bit less formal than we would do in, for example, one of our LinkedIn lives. I've got Carla Schechtman here. Carla owns a billing company that specializes really in behavioral health. And as many of you know, behavioral health, ABA, and individual psychotherapy and things of that sort, substance abuse disorder related therapy, those are all things that are out there. And so we thought it would be kind of a timely and topical discussion to have Carla on. So Carla, excited to have you. We've spoken a couple times before this kind of in prep, but tell everybody, who are you, where are you, and what do you do?
Yes. Like you mentioned, my name is Carla. I run a billing company. We've been around for a good amount, 12, maybe 13 years almost right now. And we specialize in behavioral health providers. We work mainly on one practice management system so we can keep my staff in the know and knowing one practice management system very well. We have clients up and down the East Coast. We're actually located here in Illinois. We have clients within Illinois and just kind of scattered all over the place. So a lot to maintain, but we're a small team. There's about seven of us right now, and we all work together from both the billing standpoint, the intake standpoint, the back end, and compliance.
It's awesome. It sounds like a lot of things all going on at once. And as a woman-owned small business, you know, advises a woman-owned small business. So we certainly understand the trials and tribulations of a small business trying to kind of make its way, you know, in this space. So I want to start. My first question is, you know, oftentimes providers are doing billing in-house, and then oftentimes they go and they outsource it to a company like yours. And obviously, if it's an outsourced service like yours, there's a contractual agreement and there's an obligation on both parts of what you're going to do. How do these contracts work? Like, what is the meat and potatoes of a third-party billing contract?
So within the contracts, they're rather lengthy. They've gotten lengthier throughout the years. It used to be mainly how will you pay, when will it be paid? But now what's been added to it are compliance efforts. What also goes into it right now that was fairly newer addition is that we have our right to run exclusions on the providers too, just kind of warning them that we may run your name through an exclusion screening database through the different states to see if there's been anything on your name. Because if there is, we're not able to work with you either. So within the contracts, there's usually a few different ways for payment. There's the percentage based, which is not very popular these days. There's the flat base, the claims per claim billing as well. And then there's also hourly. I think there's probably going to be a big shift from most of these percentage-based billing contracts to flat rate, the way everything's running. States are passing different laws pretty much daily at this particular point. There's so much stuff changing, and some of their sunset provisions that might sunset in 7 years, might get extended, might not. I think from a compliance standpoint, it may be easier for the shift to go to flat rates. But no matter what the contract states in there, you have to have now, it's very important to have a lot of the compliance efforts in there, that we're watching the state and the federal regulations, that we're running your exclusions on top of just the regular billing and maybe coding if you're doing that.
Yeah, I mean, the exclusions piece is an important piece of the puzzle, because providers tend to not do the exclusions. And, you know, when we're doing a lot of work on our end on the compliance side, we have conversations with providers all the time, because the OIG's guidance on exclusions is not great. It's when you get hired, you should have someone running an exclusions check on a new hire. And then it's periodically thereafter, which is really not very clear. And the one thing that I've always said to our provider clients is you should be doing these exclusion checks every month, because if you have somebody that gets hired in January and you do an exclusions check and they're good, and then they get adjudicated in February for some malfeasance that leads them to be excluded, and in the very highly unlikely event of either a water landing or OIG getting an exclusion done quickly, because you know there are times where the exclusion isn't done until after a provider has been in jail, released, off probation, and then the exclusion comes in a year or two later. But if, for example, a person got hired in January, they were adjudicated in February and got excluded in March, and you don't run them until the following January, you've got 9 months where someone was in the mix doing something. And while the OIG will say that exclusions aren't mandatory, if you are billing for an excluded provider, you will get, you know, the civil monetary penalty. So that exclusion check is super important, you know, to get that done. And it feels good to hear that that's, you know, that's going on. But Matt, so I want to go to you, because one of the things that Carla talked about is this shift from percentage based to fee based. And the one thing that's always concerned me when I was working at the OIG was instances where a biller had a percentage based reimbursement or payments schedule where it was on typically on what was received. If you have a provider with a lot of denials, your billing company is not going to get paid because it's on a percentage of the received, the accounts receivable. And my concern was always that it was in a billing company's interest to obviously have maximum amount of money. And, you know, you'd hear these stories about a billing company submitting a claim for a level five, but it was really a level three. The billing company takes that money, and then they, in the back end, they rejigger everything to make it look like it was really a level three. And we see cases involving the billing companies being part and parcel to the fraud. And obviously, what we're really talking about is a potential violation of the anti-kickback statute. So, you know, Matt, and particularly at the UPIC, you know, I would love to get, when I would get the 855 forms, the CMS 855s, and they actually put the billing company name and a contact person. You know, that was a great investigative lead, because if you didn't know who the billing company was, this is now a piece of the puzzle, right? So this intrinsic connection between the billing company and fraud, waste, abuse is there. You know, Matt, I just want to go to you, because that's a, you know, in the contract world, that's a piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. And first, thanks for the shot across the bow, knowing that I was the head of the exclusion staff when I was at the OIG. Appreciate that. But yeah, you know, at the UPIC, you know, one of the first things we would do is to see, you know, who the billing company was, who the representative was, so we could go talk to them about what compliance efforts, you know, they were making, and, you know, what was the actual relationship, what the process was. So if you could just talk a little bit about, you know, just random provider, what's your process? How does it work that you, what do you receive and what do you do with what you receive to get the claim out?
Okay, that's a good question. This is where I become really strict with the staff. We have a process where the provider is choosing within the practice management system. For behavioral health, there's a lot, there's not as many codes as there would be for other medical providers. So there's a certain subset, and it gets even smaller depending on what your licensure level is. So first off, since they are picking out their CPT codes within the practice management system when they're charting, we are pushing the policies, making sure that they understand the definition, making sure that they understand where the timestamp is, making sure that they don't get lazy and just use the default time set up in the system from like, oh, it's 60 minutes from 4 to 5, 5 to 6. Reiterating, hey, you know, every session of yours is going to be 60 minutes on the dot. You guys have to really be meticulous about paying attention if it started at 4:02 or 4:03 and ended at maybe 5:01 or 4:58. That's huge in the behavioral health industry, that timestamp. And then kind of going through the bullet points of what needs to be in the documentation for that, because medical providers are a little bit more used to this than behavioral health providers have been. These, all of the notes that need to be taken, that's a little bit of a struggle. So making sure that they have access to the Medicare policies, both the LCDs and the NCDs when it comes to the government billing, and any Medicaid policies that are out there as well, because those can vary, to kind of look at both of them. Your government policies tend to be more entailed than a lot of the commercial plans. I know some of the commercial plans will put out a policy that looks great And then you kind of are reading into it. I'm like, leaves you with a lot of unanswered questions in there too. So there's a lot of investigative in that as well. So the provider chooses the CPT code within the system. It goes into a queue so we can kind of check it. The big thing right now is the modifiers for telehealth. It's a little bit more complicated than you would imagine because all the different carriers for telehealth want different modifiers. They want it this way. Medicare wanted it, for instance, as if it was in the office during the pandemic because you normally would have seen them or where you would have seen them during the time. With the 95 modifier, that will be going away. We need to watch what final rule is published towards the end of the year. So keeping up with all of these kind of things, then it's all back end after that. The AR follow-up, the normal billing stuff. But what we run, and this is where I become really strict, any overpayments need to be reported right away to the insurance carrier. We need documentation that all the overpayments have been reported, put it within the AR notes. But in addition to that, we have a compliance plan in place with our billing company, and we run what's called the compliance audit on our providers every single year. We're running through anything that might have been missed within the practice management system, patient credits, insurance credits. We're looking at the back end claims to make sure that all the tax ID numbers, the NPI numbers, everything's still in the right spot, that nobody messed with our practice settings. Anything that we find off, anything that was corrected, any actions that were taken, and the biller signs off that they did that. We scan it back into the compliance folder that we maintain for each provider, and that's annual. That's a big component of our compliance plan when we're running it. But also I recommend to the providers, and I think this is very important if you're an owner, especially of a clinic, I think it's a very good idea to do a random audit on your clinician's charts. Once every 6 months, take 10 charts, set some sort of policy up and make sure that they're following the proper documentation requirements as well.
Yeah, you know, so I'm glad you brought that up because we really tout very strongly on our provider side work with our law firms and our providers. You know, the OIG has what they call the model compliance guidance. There's a website that gives you, you know, a bunch of these. I'm going to be talking in a few weeks on our next LinkedIn Live. We're going to be speaking with a former lawyer from Office of Counsel to the Inspector General about this. But the OIG has a 7-point model compliance guidance. And one of them is self-audit. And the one thing I always say is that the fox shouldn't be watching the hen house. The coding or the billing manager should not be doing the audits on the billing or coding clerk. If they have coders in the place, you really need to have an objective third party come in and do some of these random audits for compliance purposes to exactly that piece of the puzzle. Like, you don't want to be caught with your pants down for having not done some random audits to see what's going on. You got to be in the I say it all the time, you got to be in the driver's seat for as long as possible. So, you know, what you're really talking about, Carlos, is kind of the next piece of this is these stopgap measures for compliance. So from a billing entity, you're doing it on the AR piece. And, you know, you brought up something which is a really important piece, which is this whole premise of credit balances, right? And Matt, we've been doing a lot of work for a Medicaid client on credit balances on the payer side, you know, and I've worked cases where there was double billing. It was an orthopedic practice and they were submitting claims to the commercial insurer for PIP from car accidents and workman's comp. They were getting denied, they were going to arbitration. And for those that know Medicare secondary payer rules, you can submit a claim to Medicare as the secondary payer, get reimbursed, but the deal is that if you get paid on the arbitration, you gotta pay Medicare back. And a lot of these providers, what they do is they scrub the claim so CMS or Medicare doesn't know that the claim was originally an MSP claim, as they call it, and they get reimbursed. And then you have all of these credit balances that are on there. And at this particular practice, some patients had thousands of dollars in credit balances and nobody was bothering to understand what the story was. They were just kind of doing it. So, you know, what you're really talking about, Carl, in some sense is these stopgap measures for compliance. So we talked already about, you recommend that your providers do self audits. You're doing these once a year kind of reviews. What are some other things that providers should be doing when they are working with their billing company? And I'll use that generically because this doesn't, just because they're using an internal billing team doesn't mean that this process should be any different, right? A lot of times using you is either more cost effective than having a full-time staff or fractional staff or part-time, but it sometimes is also just set it and forget it kind of a deal, right?
Yeah, if they're using a third party biller, and I think this is especially the case if the third party biller is entering the coding themselves, that starts to make me a little bit nervous. And I believe that if they're running an effective compliance plan in the office, they should be checking with the billing company information. So if they sent over, like you were speaking about before, and where we're working is mental health. Say they send over a 45 minute session over to the billing company, and the billing company, and this could be purposeful, this could be inadvertently sending through a 60 minute session for all of this work. I really recommend the provider's offices review their remittances, their EOBs from the insurance company, so they see what was billed out and they can compare it to what they sent to the billing company as well. So that's a little bit separate from looking at the clinical documentation. Now you're looking at what was actually billed and sent out to the insurance company and making sure it matches up.
Right, a little bit more of a mechanical process, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. Before I turn it back over to Matt, so your team, do you employ anybody who's a certified coder where you've got any clients where they just give you the medical records and say, code these and bill them?
No, we do not.
Right. So you're really on, it's strictly the financial piece, right? So you're not making determinations about the right code per se, but for sure, because you're on the accounts receivable piece, you do see the things that are problematic, right? Whether it be overuse of codes and things, because in the AR, you're running some reporting to see where it is. So Matt, this becomes an important piece from a Frogways compliance perspective, right? Because, you know, there's audits, there's denials, investigative inquiries that are done by UPICs, right? The OIG. I mean, it's an important piece of the puzzle that the billing company not be really in, quote unquote, in bed with the provider on this, right? The objectivity has to be there.
Yeah, because, you know, the first thing that a investigator is going to see is, you know, what is the scope of the scheme? Does it involve the billing company that's getting a percentage of the proceeds? Are they involved in the submission of the false claims? Do they know that it's not truthful, but they're submitting it anyway? How do they gain from the proceeds? All of that goes into the investigation. And now with the, you know, as Eric says, this is the era of the audit, you know, when one of your or many of your clients, some of your clients are going to get audited, you know, you don't want to be caught in that web. So you have to take the precautions needed to make sure that you have the information that, yeah, we looked at these things. We informed the provider that these things were out of the norm. They've made changes or not, but you have to have your defenses in place to do that. And so my question is, is there a fear out there of these audits? Are providers saying, hey, I don't want to be involved in this particular payer, or it's too complicated, I don't want to do this, I just want to stay away from that? Is that happening more and more, this yes. abrasion that everyone's fearing?
Yes, it is. Actually just recently, I had a provider that doesn't typically take any government programs. It wasn't necessarily their specialty, but but she was starting to think about it and had asked how long would the process take? What does it look like? And I said, well, here's some things that we need to inform you of. This is what's going on right now. Here's the documentation requirements. Here's the policies. This is all the things that you want to make sure of. They came back and had changed their mind after they reviewed it all because they're really nervous about taking that on right now. I do find that part of it unfortunate, because it seems to be that the providers that really want to make sure that they're doing the right thing, making sure that they get everything right, become fearful at the end of the day. And it's a lot of what they're hearing out there. One of my concerns is, be careful when you get onto these listservs. I have providers asking me all the time, oh my goodness, this is what this provider told me on the listserv. Just go ahead and code it this way. I'm like, don't do that. Don't listen to anybody out there right now. Goodness, is anybody from the OIG listservs watching what's going on?
Right.
Providers say that. Don't do it. That's a bad idea. I understand. And this is what I tell providers all the time. what they'll say on these listservs is just go ahead and code it and it'll get paid. I'm like, because when you code it and you send it out, the payer is assuming that you're following their policy, that you understand. It's going to be a problem when they come back later and audit. So
right.
That's the very first things now I open with a lot of providers. There's when I have a new client sign on, I go through a whole list of like, okay, here we are. Are you aware of all of these things? Because we want to be careful from day one when we get started with them.
Well, so you bring up a really good point, which is opinions are a little bit like a-holes. Everybody's got one, right? And the thing that you actually are saying, and you can cross this over into traditional, you know, kind of billing and coding, is that, you know, we see this a lot in the device industry, where the manufacturer gives suggested coding advice. And the problem with that is that it's not always right. It's in the manufacturer's financial interest to get you as the provider to see what, you know, the potential money is going to be. And we see this constantly. Last year, I did a self-disclosure for $2 million on a provider who was taking advice from the manufacturer on a Doppler, transcranial Doppler, TCDs. This is like the biggest area now. And what this provider was doing was he was billing for a diagnosis that the patients didn't have to justify the use of the CPT code to be able to submit it, and was relying upon the manufacturer's advice to do this. So it's a little bit of the same thing, right? Like, you see this constantly on these billing and coding sites, these chat boards where, you know, there's advice being given out. And at the end of the day, you've got to go back to the policy. You've got to go back to the MAC, if it's Medicare, or provider, you know, education team or something like that. And look, at the end of the day, I'll be the first to tell you, if you were to go and speak to somebody at a Medicare administrative contractor, they're not going to tell you how to bill something. They're going to kind of explain to you what the policy says and what the requirements are, and it's up to you to interpret that, right? So it's even more circuitous because you're still not getting kind of that meat and potatoes. But, you know, these chat boards tend to be the dirty white underbelly of what, you know, of what goes on in some regards. Because, you know, I once had a project where I talked to a doctor about doing some audits, whatever, and the provider came back and said, I don't need to do that. It's not a problem. And my response was, is it not a problem because you haven't been audited yet? Or is it not a problem because you've been audited and you passed? Or it's not a problem because your buddy down the street is billing for it and they haven't gotten in trouble for it? Like, in which category is it not a problem, right? Because it's only a problem until it's a problem, right? So, you know, but do you find, and we've got a few minutes left, and I want to kind of focus on these last few minutes, like, how much pushback or resistance do you get from your clients where you're talking to them about some of these things that you're seeing that are both industry related and then even granular, because you're doing the AR, you're seeing, hey, there's an uptick in this code. You weren't doing this code before, or you're adding this modifier. You weren't using this modifier before. How much resistance do you get when you identify some of these things that become these stopgap measures for compliance?
Yeah, I mean, you end up with a lot of providers. One of the things I want to say that I sort of changed the way that I approach everything now that makes it easier is I come out right out the door. This is what it needs to be. You have to understand, instead of assuming that they know when they first sign on. So I start that way. So it definitely changes the dynamic between myself and the client. When I need to talk to them, it's like, here, I'm not coming out a year later saying, hey, are you following policy? And getting a lot of pushback from that. But what this is one of the big things I get a lot now. You're trying to fit, we're talking about policy, a square peg into a round hole when it comes to behavioral health. I'm like, I understand where you're coming from. One of the big things that has happened over the last decade is a shift in calling them patients to clients right now. And I've been on the fence about this, but pretty much I just announced to my staff recently, I said, we're sticking with patient, we're billing health insurance. If you change the word on what you're billing for, it kind of changes the whole concept in terms of making sure that you're coding the diagnosis codes to what they're supposed to be, because it's a patient now, not necessarily a client. And you're also billing health insurance. I used to feel mean pushing down on that kind of stuff. But the other thing is, and again, a lot with behavioral health, let's talk about this timestamp. Again, being, I know I'm going back to this, but being very meticulous about paying attention to it, because I know it's easy to kind of keep going and not look at the clock and see where you're at with the
person. Right.
But you really, really absolutely need to be, because if I was an auditor, which I'm not, but if I was, one of the first things I'm going to look for in mental health, wow, this is very unusual that every session starts on the hour and ends on the hour for the whole year.
Right. Which would be impossible, because if you actually get, well, look, we know that in the psychotherapy world, as they call it, the shrink's hour is really 50 minutes. So you theoretically could start on the hour, but you're ending at the 50 minute mark, right? So yeah. And you know, you brought up a good point. And Matt, as the wrap up, you know, in the Medicaid space, so similar to like, it goes from patients to clients. In the Medicaid space, there was that period of time when in the Medicare and Medicaid space, we would work on a case and somebody who had Medicare was known as a beneficiary, and somebody in the Medicaid space was known as a recipient. And the big difference was always that because Medicare was an entitlement program, you became a benefactor of that. And because Medicaid was considered a needs-based thing, you were the recipient of it. There has been a tectonic shift in the Medicaid space from calling people recipients to calling them members, right? And because it's mirroring in the MCO or HMO space, right? The term is that you're a member, you're not a recipient or a beneficiary. So it's interesting to see that there's this kind of shift, whether it's for political correctness or not, but that there's this shift in kind of the way that these things are defined, right? So Matt, last piece of the puzzle, behavioral health, huge area, with things like ABA, substance abuse disorder, group therapy, individual therapy, people that need to get therapy because of having not interacted with humans for 3 years from COVID. It's really becoming a thing, right? The telemedicine, the telehealth. Where do you see Carla's role going? And third-party billers, this was eye-opening to me, by the way, that you're spending a stronger amount of time and effort on the compliance piece. But Matt, final thoughts on that piece as it relates to fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance.
Yeah, I see the role of the biller, you know, especially in this area of behavioral health, becoming more and more important to program integrity, because you have a very vulnerable population. You know, this is not a population where, as an investigator, we're going to go out and talk to these folks, because, you know, some of their diagnoses don't allow for that, and we don't want to upset them. So we are going to be coming to the provider and the biller to find out what happened. So the more active of a role you can play in quality assurance, compliance, and program integrity, and making sure those bills, which are being submitted in a program that relies on trust, you know, that they are going to be well supported by the documentation, and that you are keeping track of what is being approved, paid, and that all of the accounting is, you know, coming up to square one at the end. And your role is going to be even more important as these audits increase in this area, because as we've seen, in everything that CMS has put out and a lot of the payers have put out, behavioral health is one of the highest priority areas of concern in these programs.
Yeah, I think, you know, look, going forward, I've always said that I thought billers and coders were the first line of compliance defense, so to speak. And this conversation, Carla, really did solidify what I've always felt to be the case. I've worked on a number of cases when I was an OIG agent where the biller was intrinsically involved in the fraud. Several cases where billers went to prison as a result of being part of the fraud, waste, or abuse that went on from a criminal perspective. So you certainly solidified what I thought to be the case all along, is that the billers and coders are that first line of defense. I'm super happy to hear, when we're talking about this, what you guys are doing for compliance and the importance of compliance from that piece of the puzzle. At the very minimum, you don't want to get caught up in something that you don't have a dog in the fight with, right? So sometimes compliance is self-preservation, you know, as well. So I'm going to give you the very last word on this, Carla. Where do you see, so we've already talked about the fact that you think there's one shift is going to be flat fee. Do you see anything else on the horizon that you're trying to either get in front of from your business or that you see being kind of where things are going to also evolve?
Yeah, I do believe that billing companies will start to play more of a management role, possibly. You have a lot of different offices that will hire receptionists that will be able to answer the phone. And I think a lot of them just say that you can go ahead and do the billing. And again, without knowing the proper policies or any of the documentation requirements. But so many things are changing, not just from the compliance standpoint when it comes to the billing and coding, but we had the implementation last year of the No Surprise Act. And it is a lot for these offices, unless you're in a big organization, to take on. So I believe with a lot of these billing companies, it would be advantageous to make sure that they're keeping up on all these regulations and making sure that they go to all their clients and letting them know, whether it be newsletters, individual meetings, hey, this is what you guys need to implement right now. We need to make sure that all of this paperwork is in order. So along with going from the percentage based to possibly a flat rate, I think it will encompass more of a management role with a lot of these offices. And we're set up for that now with remote working. We don't necessarily need to be in the doctor's office 24/7 to pull that off now.
Yeah, that's a good point. I certainly think that's true. I'd like to say there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but there's a lot of things that you need to do that aren't going to be paid for at the end of the day to kind of keep the ship moving in the right direction. So this was great. I think, you know, at some point we're going to have you back, Carla, to talk about kind of, okay, this is what we talked about. Are the things that you were seeing that you thought were going to happen? Are you doing more of this kind of practice management type stuff? So, you know, kind of a year in review, let's see where we are at some point. So I appreciate having you on. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you so much. Good, it was great.
As always, good to see you, Matt. Next week, we'll have another great episode. The team, the band will be back. Maybe we'll all be wearing collared shirts. Maybe we won't. I don't know. We'll see. If you're getting our newsletter, I do have one collared shirt. It's an old one from the OIG because the OIG would give me 100 different collared shirts to wear with the badge. So I do own one. Thank you for asking. If you're getting our newsletter, you're seeing this through our newsletter. If you're seeing this through LinkedIn, you can get our newsletter by sending us an email at hello@advizehealth1word.com. Sign up for the newsletter. You can get that. We'll see you at the next LinkedIn Live in September. I'm going to be having David Blank, former Office of Counsel to the Inspector General Lawyer, now in private practice. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of things relative to overpayment, self-disclosures, the requirement under the Affordable Care Act to report overpayments within 60 days, plus that 6-month investigative time period. So it's going to be a great discussion. We look forward to seeing you on that. And we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable next week.